I'd like to welcome everyone to this meeting of this event. It is the first fringe event being held at the ASP Labor Conference. I thank very much the conference organisers for allowing us to undertake this event. We are the ASP branch of the Australian Fabians. You would have seen our banner as you came in. The Fabians are a grassroots organisation. We're not affiliated with the ALP, but we share a lot of things in common with the ALP. And according to our constitution, you can't be a member of any other Labour Party if you want to become a Fabian. So we're, by implicit assumption, mostly ALP people. We're progressive, we're left of centre, we believe in broadening the discussion. So we like to be a way of getting a lot of different perspectives into the ALP and into the grassroots and into the community and thinking about some of these big picture topics. So engaging with academics, political leaders, all sorts of people. And there is an opportunity in this year, of course, our 100th year in Canberra to celebrate the achievements of Canberra and a Labour government, and reforming spirit as part of that Labour government that's often punched above its weight, that's wrestled with key issues. For example, we've had some of the first explorations of things like same-sex unions in the ACT, competitive across the country, and we've had, shall we say, government innovations such as minority governments, which we're quite used to in the ACT, which the rest of the country is, of course, less used to. I'm very delighted to be here at the conference. I'm very delighted to introduce and to welcome two illustrious stars of the ACT and ALP firmament. We have our current Chief Minister, Katy Gallagher. We have the first Chief Minister, Rosemary Follette. And if nothing else in this political year, I think it's also a great thing to recognise a progressive government that has consistently put women forward in leadership. So I will start with just saying the scene, and we're just doing a Q&A. There will be no speeches, but there will be questions, and we're also happy if obviously Rosemary and Katy want to talk to each other and ignore me for a while. That's perfectly acceptable too. I'd like you to cast your mind back to 1989, the year of self-government. Obviously, we had the great Bob Hawke as our Prime Minister. We had a number of other leaders who, shall we say, fallen by the wayside. I don't know if anyone remembers John Bannon so well, or the fact there were three different Queensland premiers during 1989. There was, of course, Nick Greener, who should probably be and of course, Rosemary is definitely a survivor of that period, and I use that word advisedly. Rosemary stepped forward to lead the ALP in the first election and formed the very first government. Of course, you had never been a member of the Assembly. It was all brand new to everyone. So you stepped right into the role of, you know, Assembly member, ALP leader, Chief Minister and Treasurer. How did that feel? Was that kind of overwhelming?
Yes, it was overwhelming at the time. It's not quite accurate to say I hadn't been a member of the Assembly. I mean, none of us had in that format. But there had been various forms of advisory body before self-government. And I was certainly a member of filled a casual vacancy in the Legislative Council immediately before self-government. It was purely an advisory body, but it did at least give me some familiarity. And I mean, there were two other things I think that were important for me. One was I had been a public servant for a long time at that stage, and like all of, you know, any of you who are public servants, you do become familiar with the pattern of Parliament and with the business of Parliament, and things like, you know, budget estimates and budget times and legislation, legislative programs. You get at least some familiarity with that. And I also, I think, had another advantage that my late father, was a Hansard reporter in the federal parliament. And that was his lifelong career. And it did tend to dominate every dinner table conversation. And we used to pick him up for dinner every night at Parliament House. You know, 6 o'clock, we'd be waiting there in the Morris Minor. So I had some familiarity, but of course nobody could have been prepared for what was the reality in 1989. After that first election, the 17-member assembly was virtually split into quarters. There were 5 Labor members and 4 of everything else, 4 Liberals, 4 anti-self-government and no-self-government people, and 4 members of a group called the Residents' Rally, who were largely formed to oppose development of various sorts, mainly the casino at the time, but virtually any development that may or may not be occurring in or near their suburb. You know, they were brought together by that kind of debate. So there were there was very little common interest amongst us. And, of course, with a whole quarter dedicated to bringing the whole notion of self-government undone, it was very difficult indeed.
And Katie, you've had quite a different experience with you've been ministering portfolios and had quite extensive experience. Do you think that, well, how well do you think that prepared you for actually then stepping up and being chief minister?
Well, it was certainly, you know, I had a fairly long apprenticeship. I was John's deputy from 2006 till he left in 2011. That's 5 years, during which time I did have periods where I acted in the top job. So there's no doubt that was very useful. I think, though, and Rosemary probably understands more than anyone, nothing can prepare you for that top job, though. And it was only after John left that I got fully exposed to the responsibilities of that job, that not just head of government, but head of a parliamentary team, you know, a leader within a political party, and a person who the buck stops with. And there is no one else behind you. And it's, sometimes it can be a very lonely experience. And, you know, I've just had my second anniversary in the job, and I'm just starting to feel that I understand the role fully and what the people's expectations are on me, what my colleagues' expectations are, and the role that I have to play in a whole variety of forums.
Thank you. Now, obviously, both of you, guest is quite different because typically everyone in Cabinet will have multiple portfolio responsibilities. Mm. Chief Ministers, like, will often be, I mean, you've both been Treasurer, you're currently Minister Taylor.
Yeah.
If you talk to Dennis Napthane or Campbell Newman, they're often not Premier and all these other things. Mm-hmm. Do you think that enhances your role as Chief Minister because you have to kind of understand the big picture and the nitty gritty, or is it just, oh my God, there's so much work, how do I get everything done?
I think there's probably 2 views on it. I mean, I always wanted to be Treasurer, and, you know, and I would never, never, ever relinquish the budget to anybody. So I was always Chief Minister and Treasurer. But I mean, in the ACT, the size and complexity of ministerial portfolios is, I mean, you've got to do it, you've got to do the job, but it really is, I think, really beyond the comprehension of most other people in politics. And I think myself that it has some drawbacks. It forces you at times, and Katie might disagree, but it does force you at times to rely on advice where you might have wanted to, you know, really dig into it a bit more yourself. And that I made errors doing that. I freely admit it. I think it forces you at times to have a fairly superficial view on things. And I mean, there are areas in Canberra, like the planning area, where the plan, I mean, just a Minister for Planning would be more than a big job. It really would. But, and yet it's just sort of tacked on to something else. The same with health. A Minister for Health is a big job. But we never seem to have the luxury of really being able just to concentrate on that subject and get not just some breadth, but also some length and some corporate knowledge in the ministry in those areas. So, I mean, that's my view anyway. I don't know if Katie would agree.
Yeah, no, look, my views on this have changed. I thought it had, and it's changed during my time as a member, not necessarily as Chief Minister. I never had any concerns when, you know, when I came into the Assembly that you would have multiple portfolios. Mm. It's just 17-member Assembly, small ministry, big job. need to get it done, everyone has to share a load. And that's a reality we're still existing under. I mean, the city's doubled during the time of self-government. The Assembly members have stayed the same. We've got new areas of policy that we have to be involved in, you know, national water policies, you know, the whole issue of energy generation and climate change was never an issue. Indeed, when I joined the Assembly in 2001, it wasn't a big issue. Now it's a whole portfolio. So we've had incremental increases to the responsibilities. The population has grown. The expectations from the community around what MLAs could and should be doing has grown. And in my time as Chief Minister, I'm firmly of the view the Chief Minister shouldn't have portfolio responsibilities. In an ideal world, he wouldn't. Because what that would allow you to do is to dive into the bits you need to manage at a strategic level. So, for example, I've been doing the Gonski negotiations and disability care. They're not in my portfolio, but they have whole of government implications. They're nation building programs that the Premier and Chief Minister has to deal with them. You can't, you know, it's not ideal because I can tell you I probably spend 70% of my time on my portfolio work and probably 30% of my time on Chief Minister work, whole of government matters. And the workload is too big, but you're never going to get any sympathy for that.
No.
And at some point in time, I think it does compromise governance. I've made mistakes too, relying on advice. I don't have the time to scrutinise my directorates that I should have. The Minister for Health should only be the Minister for Health. They should be able, where there is a concern, to go and spend days and days and days working on those problems, and there just isn't the resources available. But that's not the world we live in, so we make do. And really the question will come to Canberra is, I think it'll become a, what type of governance do you want? Because we're going to have to make compromises at some point if the Assembly doesn't change its size.
Thank you. Rosemary, the experience of minority government, as you said, it was, you know, there wasn't a lot of common ground. How did you therefore weave something together where you could all, well, I guess support your government? Because there were very different views. And I think it's interesting because minority government isn't just a case of getting agreements at the start of a term and assuming they continue till the end of a term. There are often bumps along the way.
Yes.
Keeping everyone on the same track.
Yes.
So what's that experience like of kind of, firstly you have to gather all the cats together.
Yes.
And then you have to constantly herd them in the same direction.
Yeah. Look, it meant that on a day-by-day basis, we were having to negotiate on absolutely everything. And you found support in different areas, depending on what the issue was, really. I think that the lack of experience of many of those early members meant that they felt overwhelmed by the work. You know, they were unfamiliar with legislation, unfamiliar with the workings of any sort of parliament, so they often felt overwhelmed. And at least initially it was possible to sort of lead people through a bit. And I had some very good negotiators on the team, which was invaluable, really. But we had to look for support on every issue, every time, every day. Often it came from different areas. Sometimes it fell apart at the very last moment, and you had no way of knowing that. But we managed to pass budgets every year, to pass legislation every year, through a very hard process of consultation, negotiation, and sometimes trade-offs. You know, sometimes you just have to do the deal and hope it stuck. So it was very difficult, but I wouldn't want to do it again. Because I think now I do believe that the other parties and other organisations would be far more demanding than perhaps they were in those early days. And I think we've seen that with some of the Greens and, you know, the issues that they raise and they're quite adamant about. I think that would make it very difficult for negotiating. But you've just got to talk it through and do the best you can. Don't always win.
Okay, do you think the demands have changed? Do you think the kind of relationship building has become more day-to-day, must keep it together?
I think the Parliament has matured.
Yeah, I do too.
And
so I should have said that, it's very true.
Yeah, well, and I'm not reflecting on my esteemed predecessors. in that way, I'm talking more about the sort of rabble of community representatives which have from time to time been catapulted into the assembly. So your residents rallies, you know, things like the Community Alliance Party, there's an evolution of that. But I think the candidates that get elected in the assembly, in order to get the quotas they're having to get, there has been a level of sanity and maturity to them, shall I say? Although there's been exceptions in my time. I've had different experiences. I've had experiences of majority government, and Wayne Berry will say to this day we weren't bastards enough to a majority government. We didn't use our majority and to the full extent that we could have. You know, and I think he'll accept good reasons for that, because we knew we weren't going to be majority government forever and that had come back to bite us on the bum. But we've had majority government, we've had minority government with a number of crossbenches where we've a similar position to Rosemary, you negotiated with different people, and invariably you'd find someone on that spectrum that would support you. Then last term we had four Greens, which sounds easy enough, but there's a wide variety of agreements and disagreements within the Greens party, so you could often be negotiating with all of them. And now we're in the situation where we've got a Green in cabinet, which I have to say has settled things down a lot, because the Green is actually inside the decision making room, it's actually being exposed to all the issues we are, and has created far more stability. And I think the only other thing I'd say is Canberrans want stable government, there's no doubt about that. They don't want to be mucked around, but they also want minority government. And so my view is it's over to us to make that work. And that's what we say. When the going gets tough, you know, we do have to compromise. Occasionally we have to call bluff and try and ram things through. But the community expects us to hold it together.
Rosemary, your position as Chief Minister, there was an unfortunate interregnum, if I can call it that, where the government fell on the floor of the Assembly.
Yes.
Now, that was quite unusual, obviously. It's not something that Cameroons will be used to, or I think Australians are kind of still unfamiliar with the concept of government changing without there being an election. So I would just like to ask, how did, I guess, the Assembly deal with that? How did Labour deal with that? And how do you think the community kind of went, oh, we're woken up one morning and there's a different Chief Minister?
I think, and it was a terrible period for self-government, because it kind of made all the doomsday people look like they were right. I felt very keenly that we hadn't been able to hold it together. It largely happened because immediately after the first budget, and I still really don't know why, the residents' rally members decided to go with the Liberals. So there was a change of government, change of Chief Minister, I should say, on the floor of the Assembly from me to Trevor Kane, who was the leader of the Liberals. And Trevor had negotiated with residents' rally. They had some residents' rally ministers. And I think that was the deal that he did. But because it was so unstable, almost inevitably it fell apart again. And Labor retook government a year or so later. I mean, I think that was just the worst possible start for self-government in the ACT. I sort of shudder a bit even thinking back on it now. But it does make me realise how far we have come. And as Katie has said, how much it has matured and become more accepted, and the community now has expectations of the Assembly that they didn't really have back in 1989. The only solace I take from that original period was that at the first subsequent election, which was 3 years later, Labor did very well. We very nearly got a majority. So I took heart from that out of a poor start, we might have been seen as the best chance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This question open to both of you. The experience of minority government is quite different because it involves negotiation, you know, kind of constant relationship management. In a majority-oriented situation, you generally don't have to deal with that nearly as much. Do you think it makes you, looking about policy, but do you think it makes you a better politician or a better communicator or a better worker, because you actually have to get people on board in ways that you may not have to do?
Look, I think people's view, in majority government, we still negotiated and consulted and compromised. And that's, I guess, going to what I said earlier. There was, you know, there were, we could have been a lot tougher as a majority government. We could have changed the way the Assembly operated. We could have changed our procedures to heavily back the majority party. We chose not to because, you know, I think we looked out a long way, but also because of the conventions of the way the parliament and a small parliament of 17 operates. So, you know, we took some very difficult decisions in that year, and we lost majority government at the first election because of those decisions. You know, we closed schools, we raised revenue, we did things. But majority government came with different responsibilities. There was an expectation from the whole of Canberra that you could just get things done, you know, and expectation from industry groups as well. So instead of, you know, having to compromise on the floor, there was this, people would come to you and just go, you should just do this. So you don't get that with minority government. People come and say, we think you should do this, and we're going to see these other people in order to win our argument. So I think it matters on the floor in terms of how the votes carve up, but I wouldn't say our procedures or the way we managed issues to a large extent were treated differently because of majority government. You know, and I think there's pros and cons for majority government, and there's pros and cons for minority government as well.
Mm. Yes, I think, I don't know that it makes you a better politician. It might make you a better negotiator at times. But it certainly gives power to the community in some ways, and perhaps that's a good thing, especially to community organisations are able to lobby different members of the Assembly with some prospect of success, you know, which is not the case with majority government all the time. So I think it reflects what Canberra's like. We've always had strong groups and strong communities and people always wanting to have their say. I mean, they may still, some of them, decry self-government, but they certainly are vigorous Democrats when it comes to the operation of that government. So I think it does reflect Canberra, it reflects our citizenship and our establishments, and I really think it's, as you know, as Katie says, we've really just got to get on with it then. Mm.
The ACT occupies, I guess, a unique place in a sense. We do a lot of work, obviously, with New South Wales State Government, but there's all these cross-border issues. We do a lot of work with state councils, but in a sense, we're both a council and a territory. Of course, particularly in the past 5 years, a lot of the intergovernmental stuff, you know, COAG's become very important. Because for us, there wasn't a COAG. So did Bob Hawke just kind of yell at people and get things done?
No. Well, it's much better than that. Okay. This was the old Premier's Conference.
Yes.
And for those of you who weren't born then, the Premier's Conference took place every year, and it was a way of the Commonwealth negotiating with the states and territories on the Commonwealth funding. And how it was done was, the Commonwealth officers would literally slip an envelope under the door of the Premier's hotel room the night before the Premier's conference. Now, as we were living in Canberra, I didn't actually have a hotel room, so some of the public servants were dispatched to the Hyatt and sure enough had an envelope slipped under their door the night before, which was the Commonwealth's offer. Now, as is traditional, of course, it was totally unacceptable. The offer was, you know, laughable. But that was where the debate started, and then it would be a debate about various programs. I think COAG's much better, particularly in terms of reform of some areas. It has allowed, I mean, it's had its ups and downs, I guess, but certainly I think it gives more emphasis to the community's needs and the programs that are to be funded, rather than just a stout between leaders of different states and territories and whoever happens to be Prime Minister and or Treasurer at the time. So it's a better system.
Yeah. Okay. There's been a lot of criticism of COAG's operation. There's something been in the room and seen at least some amazing things being agreed and achieved. I mean, we had during the agreement on disability care, kind of going forward with the Better Schools Plan. Nationally, obviously, ACT time with their signatories. Have you got any insights on the kind of forums and negotiations you've been involved in? What works particularly well?
Well, I hate to say it, maybe his presentation appears to have changed from Rosemary's time, but there isn't a letter that slipped under the door, but, you know, my view is you become aware of what the COAG agenda is going to be by reading The Australian probably 2 days or 3 days before the meeting. There are, you know, offers put through the bureaucracy about what's going to be put on the table. We have another structure called CAF, which is the Council of Australian Federation, which is the states and territories which meet before, and we're all outraged by the offer of the Commonwealth.
And
then we all, then the Prime Minister usually meets with the large states, cuts a deal, and then they turn up at COAG and tell everybody what's going on. That's a very superficial way. But so some of that still happens. I think COAG's an effective body once priorities are identified and setting out work plans and trying to get national agreement on things that are important to people. I think it's been useful there. There's a whole layer of function and dysfunction that sits around it, but I think that's true of most federated models. You know, you look at anyone that's got a national body and then state branches, you'll see similar pushing to and fro on it.
I think the federation does allow some, you know, really important issues to be dealt with effectively. And the one that always comes to my mind is guns, gun control. That was taken up by a Conservative government, admittedly with the strongest of motivations after we had seen such ghastly slaughter in Tasmania. But it was a difficult debate for many states, and it was difficult for the ACT as well. You know, we had a vigorous debate with the gun lobby here. But nevertheless, we did get a national outcome because everybody saw that there was an objective that was well worth achieving. So, you know, I think perhaps it's not neither the Premier's Conference nor COAG, but the nature of our federation that at times we can address really significant issues in a meaningful way.
And disability care.
Disability care.
You know, that would never go anywhere unless, you know, the federal government let it, but the states lined in and agreed. And, you know, I don't think perhaps we all showed the leadership we needed to show, as was evident in that gun example, but eventually we got there. And, you know, for people who have a disability, wherever you live in the country now, there will be... WA actually has a very good disability system, which we're actually, many of us are trying to aspire to. So I think for anyone who lives around the country now, the standard of care has been lifted up, which is ultimately a great outcome.
Now, one last thing. The ACT's been a reforming government throughout its, you know, it's done a lot of great things, and I think it's done a lot of innovative things in terms of the policy and programs we've seen. Rosemary, one thing you're particularly proud of, and one thing you didn't quite get done but you wanted to.
Yes, oh, it's really hard to sort of find one thing, isn't it? I think one thing that I've become prouder of in the light of recent history is that I did, from the start, set out to improve the lot of women. And quite overtly, nobody said I was having a gender debate or anything, this was just I was for women. And so we did get things done, like insisting that 50% of government boards and committees and so on have women. Things like funding the domestic violence crisis service, improving the legislation around rape to make it actually possible that there would be convictions and make it easier on complainants. So I think that stance that I took for women, I was pilloried at the time, and but it would be worse now, I think. It would be worse now. I'm proud of that, and as I say, in light of recent history, I'm even more proud that that's how we did it, and that it did seem to find favour with our Canberra community. You know, this is, I think, the most progressive of communities in Australia, and we can all be very proud of that. Something I've always felt that at the outset there, it was very difficult to actually sell the notion of self-government, and it's still a debate I'm sure that, you know, Yvette and Katie and others, you'll still find people saying, clever people saying, you know, it's really just a glorified council, isn't it? No, it's not. I mean, well, how glorified? So I think that that sort of failure to really entrench it with, you know, kindergarten children right through to the universities and the workplaces and everywhere, I find that's disappointing. I don't know what else I could have done, but I would have liked to have given it a bit of a try.
Thank you, because I'm sure your best years of reforms are still ahead of you. Yeah. I'm sure we're only working our way out. Is there anything, kind of, is there any hallmark reform in the ACT or federally that you can look back on and be like, this is the key idea of labour reforms that I would like to have done or would be building on?
It's hard, you know, when we were fourth-term government, so when you go back and actually look at the changes that have occurred since 2001 or 2002 when we started our legislative program, you know, we've achieved so much. I mean, we have changed with the way, I think, you know, we've, in a sense, implemented things that are core Labor values all the way through. I mean, look at our same-sex law reform. You know, that started in earnest, I think, in 2004, and it's still underway now. But these are just things that wouldn't be priorities to Conservative governments, but we're just getting on and doing it slowly. But, you know, things like the child and family centres that we've established, it's, you know, the health system that we're building. I mean, there's so many things, and it goes down to little examples of non-government organisations that get support. And that's the point I was trying to make in my speech today. It's not necessarily just the big ticket items that you gets lots of press. It's all the other labour values that are instilled across the public service and the work we do that makes a big difference. Like, you know, Wodonga Nimitidjar, which is the Aboriginal Health Service, had very low levels of government funding. I think it now gets over $1 million a year and is the primary deliverer of care to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across the ACT. You know, not many people know that, but that's the kind of partnerships we have. So, you know, there's lots more to be done. And, you know, my job was made a lot easier by having people like Rosemary who paved the way for us. And so, you know, I think, you know, when I came into the job, it wasn't shock horror, you know, so to speak, from having
that's
a woman
good,
in the
isn't
job.
It?
Yeah, so thank you, Rosemary.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. You're very welcome.
And there are membership forms on your chairs. Please join.
Thank you on the forum. I think it's a really good idea.
Thank you.
And I hope that you get to